Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. It's a beautiful day to be alive. I'm very happy to have a lot of really cool sponsors on the podcast. And let's get into some of those right now. Susan Robb out of Toronto, Canada, lives out her mission to inspire others. Susan is a client partner for Center for Leadership Studies, original home of situational leadership. COS is deployed in over 70% of top Fortune 500 companies around the globe. If you want to learn more about how to build your leadership capacity or hire a speaker for an event, contact her at susan.robb, R-O-B-B, at situational.com. Susan has helped us get a bunch of guests on the show, Coach Jim Johnson, Paul Templer, Dave Andrechuk, a lot of guests that were really powerful episodes. So if you want to have a speaker at an event or put something together, please contact them at situational.com. Now, I'm very lucky to have three breweries that I love sponsoring this podcast. And the first one is Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. They have one of the best tap rooms I've ever been to. Just really cool murals and 16 rotating taps and different things every Sunday. You got to take your wife, take your boyfriend, go check out Demented Brewing. They just released Soul Reaper, their American Pale Ale, and they're going to be releasing C4, their summer IPA, this Sunday. Go check them out at Demented Brewing. Give them some love on Instagram and Facebook. Manskirt Brewing is another sponsor of this podcast that really helps us out. Manskirt's located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, where you can now go do like a three brewery tour. But make sure you check out Manskirt and Joe in his Manskirt. Now, they got the Battleship Beer Fest on Saturday. They're planning a 4th of July party at the brewery, which they're going to be celebrating on Saturday, July 1st. Keep an eye on Facebook for those details. They just released Pleated Wheat, their collaboration Hefeweizen with Two Ton Brewing, a light summer ale with yuzu and grapefruit. That is Demented Brewing. Go give them some love at www.manskirtbrewing.com. Adirondack Brewery, located in Lake George, New York, just a really pretty brewery right across the street from the lake. If you're visiting, make sure you go to check them out. If you're visiting the Adirondack area, one of my favorites to go check out. Done a lot of cool things there. Now, they're excited to launch their wave number one of the Lake George's IPA, an Adirondack-style IPA whose hop profile will rotate with our hometown's four distinct seasons. Wave one showcases El Dorado hops, which contribute notes of papaya, honeydew melon, and a touch of mint. A malt bill with generous amounts of flaked oats and a beautiful hazy appearance with a creamy mouthfeel. Wave one will be on draft at bars that serve lots of craft beer and beverage centers throughout Capital Region, as well as in their Hop Project Variety Pack. And wave two can be expected in the fall. They also have the Adirondack Wine and Food Festival this weekend, which is going to be right across the street at the Charles R. Wood Park. They're going to be bringing out the food truck, serving some delicious beers. So that sounds like a great event. Go check out Adirondack Brewing. Check them out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that fun stuff. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. I host Trivia Wednesday nights at Tap House 15 in Wharton, but we have Trivia all over the state of New Jersey. Different locations. You can win prizes to New Jersey breweries, prizes to the actual place you're playing at, even if you're in last place. There's bonus items online that'll get you extra points. It's just a great night out and a lot of fun for everyone. Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, we have a really powerful episode today. Chris Picciolini joins us, and he was a former neo-Nazi, leader of the neo-Nazis and skinheads, and about 20 years ago, really turned his whole life around, and now today works with people who were part of hate gangs and committed hate crimes and trying to change their life around. And the guy's really done a 180 and changed his whole life and does a lot of powerful things and has a really unique and powerful story. So I think you'll enjoy the episode. We also talk a bunch of spooky things at the end, some freaky stories. So with that, enjoy the podcast.
This is Christian Picciolini, author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, and you're listening to... Damn it, I forgot what it is. Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Good morning, Nino. That was my best, Chris Russo.
Oh.
Mad Dog.
Gotcha.
Mad Dog. But Mike Berlow, hello. How are you?
Hanging in there. Hanging in there.
Well, that doesn't sound like... That sounds like you're close to killing yourself, but...
No closer than usual.
Well, by hanging in there, I hope you don't mean like Chris Cornell style.
Nah, maybe Robin Williams style.
As long as it's not David Carradine style. I think you'll be right.
I'll make sure when I put on the female panties, I'm wearing my verbal shenanigans.
No,
when
it comes to no, please don't do that. As no one will see it, one.
Make sure the reports say I was the Burles. A verbal shenanigans.
As nobody sees it, one, and then two, the only all your loved ones have to see verbal shenanigans. That's somehow get blamed for it. But welcome back to another fun-filled edition of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
Hmm.
What's up, buddy?
Yeah, just hanging in there, you know, doing a little small stuff here and there.
Small stuff. What does small stuff mean?
Well, let's see what I do over the weekend. I found a new minor league baseball stadium in the area.
Okay.
40 minutes
Which
away.
One?
It's the Sussex County Miners.
Yes. I've heard that before. I heard someone was talking about that when I was at the Somerset Patriots game recently.
Yeah, they're in Augusta, New Jersey.
That's pretty up there.
Yeah, well, it's like 40. It's not really that far away, but it's all back road, so that's why even though it's like 20 miles, it takes like an hour.
How is that? Did they play in a farm?
No, it's a nice setup. They have the field. They have a restaurant connected to the field where you after the game you can get some drinks.
Are they independent or are they?
Yeah, they don't. They're in the independent league with no affiliation with any baseball club.
Yeah, like that's what the Patriots are too.
Yeah,
but so was it cool?
It wasn't that bad. They were playing the Dominican Republic. So
the Dominican Republic, like the whole country.
Their national team.
Really.
I guess with independent, there's only a small amount of independent teams, and obviously for costs, they can't always be traveling. So a lot of times they'll play, like, some of the Caribbean islands and their national teams to prep them up for, like...
How many home runs did Big Poppy have?
No home runs. In the first inning, a couple guys came hitting the wall, but other than that, it was just pretty much small line drives.
I don't care about the other guys. How many did Big Poppy have?
He went 0-for-0.
How many innings did Pedro pitch?
I didn't see him warm up in the bullpen. Maybe the next day was his
go day?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. So, no home runs.
Yeah.
Out in the middle of Augusta. Okay, was it enjoyable? Was it full? Was it?
It definitely wasn't full. There was, if I had to guess, about 600 people there, 600, 700. I mean, it was nice for the kids. It was the troops could after the game sleep on the field, the Boy Scout troops. So.
Oh, they meant like the troops, like
yeah.
Come on down.
That's a weird little thing there, Mr.
Being
Trump.
Being American, and you could sleep on the minor league field. I don't know. I've been doing everything as Scott Stapp today again.
I noticed
that. Before I was trying to record the ads, I didn't really get to it yet. But I started like, welcome to the show. I'm like, wait a minute. That's Scott Stapp's voice. Again, it's the Marlins song.
Marlins, they will soar.
Come on, Marlins, soar. But, yeah, so okay, so they salute the troops. They let them sleep on the field.
Yeah, that was a
in
cute
the trenches.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cute little field, for lack of a better term. I mean, we got front row seats, so... it was all right.
don't sound too excited about the Marlins.
Well, I'm not going to sit back and go, oh, my God, it's the most amazing experience ever.
What is the crowd like? Any old guys keeping stats? Those are my favorite guys.
No, nobody around there. It was mostly kids just running around. Some kid was playing like a robot behind us, and he broke it, and I had to give him some pieces that broke under my seat.
So, wait, so the pieces of robot exploded under your seat?
Yeah, he was behind me, and of course, as a kid, he dropped it. And,
stupid kid.
And I won't say it's the most best-built robot ever, so pieces were flying. I think it had like a tail or something.
So you're saying it did not win the award for most best-built robot?
No, it was...
most best-built.
No, it went to China again.
It's the most best-built robot. Up there, that might work. Are there any animals at the game?
No, but they have a dog night where you can bring your dogs around.
Oh, I guess I know where you're going.
Monday nights. Thirdly, we got podcasting.
Sorry, man.
Sorry, I'm on the field with Callie.
Augusta dog night again.
It's weird, the troops are still here.
Sir, I don't care if you were in Vietnam. You have to leave the stadium immediately.
All right. So the game was fun. Nothing crazy. Poppy hit a home run. I get it. What else did you do?
Went to a new winery, went down to cousins. My cousin had a third baby, so they finally got a babysitter to actually adult for once in a couple weeks. So,
third baby. Oh. Mm.
Yeah, they have Irish twins, too. One after the other. God bless them.
Another winery. Now, you guys are quite the winery-like connoisseurs at this point.
I wouldn't say connoisseurs is just that, hey, there's a winery, let's drink.
Well, all right. I'm okay with that. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
These were pretty good. They had some different varieties. We bought a bottle of Capovino, which is coffee-infused wine.
Coffee wine. I don't know if I'm into that.
It worked.
Like, what is it, like a Merlot or something?
No, I would say it's probably like a white wine combination with some cappuccino flavors, and it worked out.
White wine with cappuccino? I don't know. Well, I mean, I'm down to try it. Yeah. I'm not a big wine guy to begin with, but I don't know.
Like, are you like down with everything, or is it just like I only like sweet wine?
I like red wine, like a dry wine. But then I'm like a guilty pleasure. I like the sweet wines, but then like. I don't like drinking wine because I feel fucking demolished in like 2 seconds. Like,
really?
I feel real hot all the time. And wine hangovers are really bad.
Haven't had that one. No. Can't say.
No wine hangovers?
I'm trying to think right now.
Go grab that bottle of wine.
I'm trying to think if I ever had a hangover in my life. And I've got plastered before, but...
You've never had a hangover?
I can't remember. I've had some wild nights and... didn't wake up with a headache.
What are you, Iron Man?
I don't know what to tell you.
You are no spring chicken. How have you had no hangover in your life?
I don't know what to tell you.
This is crap. We're going to make... All right. Get to the fridge. Let's go. We're going to make this hangover happen.
All right. I got Stone Ripper going here.
What do you mean you never had a hangover? I have hangovers that, like, make me want to, like, you know, become religious. Like, they hurt.
Nope.
No headaches in the morning?
No. Not after a drinking.
No puking the day after.
I mean, I've been sick, but I never woke up with the full, I can't move or do anything.
No beer butt.
No, I can't say I have that.
You might be extraterrestrial.
I might be the one.
He's the one that walks among us. But
the new Matrix series.
Yeah, when I went camping, I did that Brofest thing again. I do every year. On Saturday.
Okay.
It was pretty mellow this time. No laser light shows or no lasers. That guy didn't come.
They didn't try to burn off your foot?
They didn't try to burn my foot. They didn't have a drone that lit up the entire forest. That guy didn't show up, so that was kind of a bummer. But even then, like, we didn't go too crazy, and I still had a little bit of a hangover in the morning.
Really?
A little bit of a headache, seeking.
Like, what is the minimum to get you to a hangover point the next day?
I don't know. I think it's, for me, it's longevity. Like, it's like, you know, I got there around noon, and we had our first beer at noon, and then go to bed to like one. I think it's when it's like a long day of drink and shots. I try to not do too many shots. Because once bourbon comes out, the whole party gets
either
started or finished.
You never end with, all right, just one, guys. Seriously. All right.
I love bourbon as much as the next guy, but that's how I try to stay away for the most part unless I'm really, like, relaxed and just having, like, a glass of bourbon. We're not really ripping shots back and forth.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, it was fun, but it was kind of relaxed, and I still had a minor hangover.
Now, what's your definition? Is it just simply a headache or can't get
up? I'm a big headache guy. As I'm getting older, I notice that the headaches are I don't really ever puke. It's got to be really, really bad. The one time you watched my dog at that wedding, and I was puking in between dumpsters, that was that was bad. And that one crept up. I didn't even know I was that bad. But yeah, that was really bad. Hey, buddy. My poor dog is limping again.
Aww. Three-legged Obi.
I hate when the dog, there's something going on, because they can't tell you what's wrong, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, so I had the bro-festing. Now, I wanted to tell this story. So Friday night, I took Gobi for a walk.
Okay.
And we took him to the tour in the park I go to all the time. And we see this guy as we're walking into the path. And he's just face down asleep on a picnic table. With like a book and a water bottle and a backpack, and he's snoring like deep. I'm like, yeah. All right, maybe he just fell asleep, or maybe he was drinking or something a little bit. And
okay.
I'm like, I even said something. I was like, yeah, he's probably fine. Like, so we do the walk, and it's about an hour and a half, hour 20 minutes. I'm gonna come back around the park, and there's three cop cars. I'm like, uh oh, and. The cops come up to me. They're like, "Oh, did you see like a single white male on your walking by himself?" I'm like, "Yeah, I mean, I saw one because there was this beagle that was like by himself." I was like, "Nobody said." I'm like, "Oh, maybe he got away or escaped." And I ran up to the beagle, and then like 30 yards ahead, I saw like a guy in flip flops. I was like, "It's kind of weird. I don't know if that's his dog."
That's the flip flop murderer.
Yeah, the old flip flop murders of Randolph Township. I didn't think anything. I tell a guy, like, "Yeah, I saw this guy." I'm like, "Oh, okay." And I hear, like, on one of the radios, like, "Oh, the canine unit's on the way," blah, blah. I'm like, "All right, what the hell's going on here?" But I'm walking back towards the car, and I go, "Oh, man, maybe they're looking for this guy that was asleep, you know?"
Okay.
And Alex goes, "He's still there." So he's still face down on the table. We see, like, his red shirt from afar. I'm like, "Is that the same? That's him?" Like, it was pretty far away. And it was him. I'm like, "Oh, man." So I go back to the cops, and I'm like, "Guys, I don't know if this is the guy you're looking for, but we just walked for like an hour and a half, and this guy hasn't moved. I don't know if you want to go check on him."
Mm-hmm.
So they go, and you hear him like, "Sir."
Oh, he growled.
Wow.
Wow, we have some backstory here.
Yeah, I was there. I was there. I experienced that. All right. One second. So the guy is face down. They're like, "Sir, sir, sir." And they're like, I could see them like nudging him. We're watching from afar. And after a while, they're like getting more aggressive, you know, like, "Sir, sir, sir." And then I hear him like, "You got Narcan on you?" I'm like, Narcan is the stuff that like prevents like heroin overdoses and stuff. Like it'll block the receptors to the brain, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they got one car comes, another car comes, and they're like, you know, they're asking for an AED and stuff like that. So we're like, "Oh my God, like we should have," you know, automatically a little bit of like guilt, like, you know, it's not your fault. But
yeah.
It's like, "Oh man, what if I called?" Like, and I mean, we left after that. We were both a little spooked, like, "Oh man, that really, you know, it stinks." So I hope the guy's alive, but.
Well, I mean, he's snoring. I haven't heard anything about death snoring.
Well, I don't know if he was snoring by the time we got around again.
Gotcha.
I don't know. It didn't sound too good. So I don't know if it was another case of, you know, opiates or pills or heroin or... Ow! I just tried to
fly spot one, a fly got nothing.
And whacked the window. So, yeah, it was kind of bizarre. Dead guy.
It always gets weird when somebody dies. I know every time I enter that house and I'll just walk around and I feel so weird with what I just did.
Yeah, I was trying to think about how many dead guys I've seen before, dead people. Not counting wakes, that doesn't count.
Okay.
Wait, you ever... didn't you say you saw someone in like India or something like that?
Yeah, I think my number is 2, which would be my grandmother on the couch. Yeah, that was a tough one.
My grandmother too in my mom's house.
Yeah, I think I was about 14. She was on the couch. I remember coming out, seeing her when I figured was sleeping. Like, "Hey, Grandma, you all right?" I didn't hear anything. First assumption, all right, she's in a deep sleep.
Yeah.
Go back, watch some TV. Parents come into the house, and all of a sudden I hear the blood-curdling scream from my mom, and... That's when the panic started happening. Ambulance came. They start doing, trying to do resuscitation. I hear the gurgles. My first thought is, "Oh, she's making noise. That's a good sign." They're like, "No, it ain't. No, it ain't."
Yeah, that's
so
tough.
That was that.
Yeah, I was. I mean, my grandma was basically in hospice. Like, you know, we knew it was coming, but it still was weird. The whole the whole it's not to somebody dying to me that's weird. It's the process after, like being we were in the house where like the coroners come and like you're kind of like they even say like go everybody should go like downstairs, you know, like you don't want to be really part of that.
Yeah, I was like outside and the EMTs were going back and forth. There was like one girl from school saying, "Hey, Mike, how's it going?" I looked at her like, "Are you're really serious with this question, aren't you?
You want to, like, come to the arcade?" Or...
And that was my first date. Thank you, Grandma.
And we've been dating ever since.
Who was that old person on your couch? Ah, don't worry about it. Don't ruin the mood.
You're looking kind of good.
You look way better than her. And the other one was India, where I was... I came up to a river. I think it was in the middle of the Ganges where they had the big statue of Buddha. And they're like, "Hey, do you want to take some pictures on the bridge before we take the tour?" I'm like, "Sure." Snapping some photos, see a bunch of people on the other side. Local guy comes up to me, smacks me on the arm. And he's like, "You see that over there?" And I look over and it looks like a brown beach ball floating in the water. I'm like, "Yeah." He says that's a dead body.
Right away, brown beach ball.
I'm just telling you what it looked like.
Right away.
I'm not filtering it because that was the scenario. I looked over. The guy didn't have any hair. He shaved his head. All you see from a distance is the top of his head, so it looked like a brown beach ball.
That would have been the giveaway. I don't know if they make brown beach balls.
When? Well, brown ball, whatever. It wasn't like huge. It wasn't like the beach balls you see at ball games.
Yeah, like if you're going beach ball shopping and brown is your choice, like.
God, man, you're boring as hell.
Like
we send you for one fun activity, you come back with brown.
I feel like that's like a little bit of a sociopath kind of thing. Like a brown beach ball. Like, look, it could be yellow, blue, pink, red, multicolored. But a brown beach ball is weird.
Yeah, weird. But
killers have brown beach balls.
Okay.
when you see a guy on the beach playing with his brown beach ball by himself. It's a sign.
Lovely weather we're having.
You want to play brown beach ball? I mean, want to play beach ball with me?
Want to play hide the beach ball?
I feel like a guy like that would call it brown beach ball, too. Like, you want to play brown beach ball with me?
Henry Killings, better known as Brown Beach
Ball. The Brown Beach Ball murder of Point Pleasant.
But, yeah, I mean, at first I thought it was like a rib. He's like, no, that's a body. And I'm like, okay, I keep... walking up there, ready to see something else, where the like it'll be pointing and laughing at me. Sure enough, we get close enough. I start seeing a flannel shirt, and realize it was a dead body. And the cops were in like motorboats coming around with like fishnets, trying to get the guy out. I go back to the van. I'm kind of like shocked by this, and all I can do is like, "Guys, is that a normal thing?" They're like, "Well, for the families that are very poor and they can't afford a funeral, they just wait till nighttime and they dump the body in the water.
Put him right in there." Yeah. It'd be even weird if you saw someone like rowing him, like a man canoe.
That was one of the stories, right? With, like the natives.
Oh, yeah. We had like one of those bits where you had to find the true story.
Yeah.
Man canoe. Row, row, row your man canoe. That sounds familiar. But I guess... yeah, I don't. I feel like one time I was in Lake George and I saw a guy under a tree that looked like he fell out of the tree and was in a really awkward position. Like, he's definitely dead. And then like, the ambulance came. He might not have been dead, but he was definitely severely injured or out of it or something else. Mm-hmm. But all right, Burlum, it's guest time.
All right,
we gotta cut this dumb conversation we're having.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you say that every time we have a conversation.
If we didn't have guests, this show would just be called Dumb Conversation. But
it's a spinoff podcast.
So let's get to the guest. Who we got?
Coming to the
stage
tonight is Christian Picciolini. He is the author of the book Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's basically a gentleman who went into the skinheads at 14... basically became the head of them at 16, started a bunch of white supremacist rock bands, pushed the message, and then finally one day he came to realization this is not the way, and now he works on bringing people out of the hate groups.
All right. I love how we got that name. Well, we got it right. So good this first time.
First time.
It's like we never recorded this a second time. Yeah, we would never do that.
There's no second takes with Michael Berlew.
We don't edit anything.
Never.
Well, here he is, Christian Picciolini. Oh yeah.
Hello, this is Christian.
Hey, Christian, it's Scott Brennan here and Mike Berlew from Verbal Shenanigans. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Scott, Mike, good. How are you guys?
Yeah, we're doing good, man. We're doing good.
Living a life.
Now, let me ask you: is it Picciolini or Piccolini?
Picciolini, like a peach.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah, we butchered that one. So Picciolini. <That's
right>. Everybody asks. It's all good, man.
Yeah, there's a lot of vowels. Come on, that's a tough one.
It is a tough one.
But anyway, Christian, thanks for giving us a few minutes here, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, man. It's really great to be here. I appreciate it. Yeah.
So, Christian, I mean, I did Mike contacted you, and I did a little research on you in the last few days. You know, there's a lot of story here, so it's hard to really start at one point. But why don't we start in the present right now? So you are the co-founder of a nonprofit group called Life After Hate, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So give us a little insight into what that is.
Sure. So Life After Hate is an organization that works with people to help them disengage from the extreme far right, hate movements and hate groups. And coincidentally, we're an organization that's completely staffed by former far right extremists, myself included. I spent 8 years of my life from 1987 when I was 14 years old until 1995 when I was 22 as part of America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group. And that's essentially spent the last 20 years of my life trying to dismantle what I helped build in the early days.
Okay, so yeah, we'll get into that in a minute. So this group now. So what do you guys actually do? Are you out there speaking? Are you out there talking? Is it like a group that people come to see you? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so it works in a variety of ways. We all do a lot of public speaking and we share our stories, and that gets the word out about our organization. Certainly, you know, we do a lot of interviews with folks like you guys that help us out.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. And, we run a program called Exit USA, which is at exitusa.org, which is kind of like a portal for people who want help disengaging or for family members who might recognize somebody, one of their loved ones who might be going down that path. And then, you know, essentially what we do is we try to work with these people, not to argue ideologically with them, but really to try and give them more resilience by dealing with some of the traumas that they've had in their lives. And then also we immerse them in situations with people that they think that they hate to challenge their narrative so that they can build an empathy again and humanize these people.
When people come to you right now or maybe even argue with you, what is generally the consensus on why they go to these hate groups? Is it something specific, a minority killed a loved one, just don't like people outside the white race? What is it?
You know, almost 100% of the time when I ask people, and I've asked hundreds of people why they joined, the number one answer is I just wanted to belong to something. The ideology is always kind of the vehicle for their anger. So I think people join any extremist group, whether we're talking about the, you know, neo-Nazi groups or the alt-right or ISIS or even inner-city street gangs, for three very fundamental human reasons. They're searching for an identity, they're searching for a community, and they're searching for a sense of purpose. And that's something that everybody goes through.
Right.
And these recruiters are very good at targeting young people or just people in general who feel marginalized, who may have what I call potholes, things that kind of deviated their path, right? It could be trauma, it could be abuse, could be unemployment or lack of education, could be mental illness, it could be a whole you know, sort of things. And then what I do is I try and fill those potholes by getting them an education, getting them mental health counseling, and getting them tattoo removal services and all the things that will help them feel more resilient, because then there's nobody else to blame. The whole point of this movement, of any extremist movement, is to blame somebody else for the problems that exist in your life without reflecting internally to see if maybe you're the cause of those problems, right? It's always the immigrants or the Jews or, you know, the refugees. It's never, you know, it's never our fault that things might be going wrong. So when you try and work on somebody and you try and make them more resilient, more self-confidence, they're then equipped and can compete for jobs and can compete in the world and can fit in without having to blame somebody else. But what challenges the ideology, because I never argue with anybody because that just makes us, you know, more polarized, I think, is what I do to address the ideology is I put them in situations that challenge their narrative. I may introduce a Holocaust denier to a Holocaust survivor or an Islamophobe to an imam or a Muslim family or somebody who's, you know, very anti-gay to an LGBTQ couple, you know, and they get put in these situations and they realize, because oftentimes it's the first time they've ever had a meaningful dialogue or interaction with the people that they claim to hate, they realize that, guess what, we're more the same than we are different, and all the differences are primarily, you know, cultural and superficial, and that it actually adds to, you know, the interesting parts of our American community. It's what our fabric is all about.
Interesting. Now, let's go back. Now, you said you joined just around 16. You said
14.
I was 14 years old in 1987 when I was standing in an alley. You know, this marginalized teenager who didn't fit in, didn't have any friends, was bullied. You know, my last name was mangled and torn apart and made fun of.
Oh man, you know? we're adding to that.
You know, Picciolini got turned into Pick My Weenie and Piccadilly and Piccalilly and just about every, you know, something weenie you could think of. And I didn't really have a place to fit in, and my parents weren't really around because they were working hard, and, you know, I felt abandoned. And here I was at 14 standing in an alley smoking a joint, and this guy walks up to me with a shaved head and boots, and this is 87, so nobody in America knew what a skinhead was. It was before Oprah and Geraldo, you know. He got his nose broke by them. Here this guy walks up to me, and he pulls a joint from my mouth, and he looks me in the eyes, and he says, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" You know, I'm like this snotty 14-year-old kid. I don't know what the hell a communist is, except for Drago in my favorite Rocky movie, or, you know, what a Jewish person is, and I wouldn't have known one if I had one standing in front of me.
Or what docile means.
Yeah, I didn't even know what the hell the word docile meant. So, you know, but this guy who was 26 years old when I was 14, who happened to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, right across the alley from where I would hang out, he was the first adult that kind of gave me a reason not to do something bad that seemed legit, because my parents would just say, "Don't do that because it's stupid," or "Don't do that because what if somebody else sees you and what will they think?" And I didn't really care about that stuff. But this guy, you know, even though I didn't know what a communist or a Jew was, he gave me a reason that showed that he was interested enough in me to give me that knowledge.
Now, was this coincidence that he was walking by, or did he pick you out?
No, I think it was coincidence that I was standing there. I don't think it was a coincidence that he picked me out.
Right.
He saw me as this, you know, 14-year-old kid who was smoking a joint, who clearly, you know, could have issues, and he saw me as somebody he could manipulate, and you know, and he did, and he lived right across the alley from where I hung out. So it was I guess I was a product of my environment by chance at that moment. I always joke too, it could have been, you know, some really great ballerinas that lived across the alley, and I could have been one of the greatest ballet dancers on earth. You don't want to see me dance. Unfortunately, it was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader, and here I was, a perfect mark for him, somebody who was searching for an identity, somebody who was looking desperately for a community. And I was ambitious, so it was really easy for him to give me a purpose, and I jumped at it, not even knowing what it was.
Now, you were saying there's main things that people get involved, main things that happen in people's lives or the situation they're in. Now, is that all you speaking from hindsight, or did you even know this at the time? That's all you wanted was to belong to a group or whatnot, or you really didn't figure this out until like years later? What got you into that?
No, I mean, I think I really desperately at the time wanted to belong to something.
Right.
And because I was so marginalized, you know, this was like the first group, and they were cool. You know, they had tattoos and drove cool cars and drank beer and, you know, smoked and all this stuff. And this was at a point when I felt the most powerless, and he empowered me. So, you know, I think I knew that I wanted to belong to something. I definitely didn't know what they were about. But I learned very, very quickly, and I learned to swallow it whole, because it belonging became so important to me, and the power that I got as part of this became very intoxicating too.
Now, when he brought you in, what was the situation? Did they have to initiate you in any way? Did they gradually bring you in and start feeding you with information? How did you kind of grow there and then basically end up becoming the leader of the group?
So it was gradual. I mean, it didn't hit me with the, you know, you got to hate minorities and, you know, kill Jews right away. It started off with trying to instill a sense of pride in me. Like they really played on the whole, you know, pride riff where they're like, oh, you know, you're a European. You should be proud of that. They're, you know, the greatest people, the smartest people. And then eventually it turned into, oh, and by the way, there are these other people that want to take that away from you. And then it would go on to, oh, by the way, those people that want to take it away from you, you should probably try and eliminate them. So it was that as far as gradual process. But at first what I was doing was, you know, as a 14-year-old kid, you know, I got a pair of combat boots and I shaved my head and started to dress like them. And they fed me with propaganda. And the propaganda that they fed me with was music. It was this white power music that was coming out of, you know, England and, you know, was educational, and they were anthems, and they made me want to be violent, and they gave me, you know, this sense of belonging to something. And I made copies of flyers and I hung around and, you know, would buy them cigarettes at the store when a 14-year-old kid could still do that in America, I guess.
Now, is this mostly like punk rock and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was racist. Racist oi, racist punk rock. You know, that was really my education. And then seeing what these guys would do and wanting to be like them, you know, was the driver. And how I became the leader was, you know, really an unfortunate incident. Clark, the guy who had recruited me about when I had just turned 16, he and the rest of the group, the older people in the group, had gone to a female skinhead's apartment. This was a girl who was a part of our crew, but because they saw her standing at a bus stop with a black guy, they went to her apartment and they beat her and they pistol whipped her and they thought they killed her. But not before, you know, painting a swastika on her wall with her own blood. And fortunately, they were arrested for that, and Clark went to prison, and you know, the group kind of, the leadership kind of disintegrated. There was nobody left, and here I was at 16 years old, the last man standing. I didn't go with them because I was still too young and not part of the inner circle. But here I was now as the oldest guy who'd been around the longest and had all these young recruits that came after me that looked to me, you know, like, what should we do? And right away I stepped into that role. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted, you know, to build this thing that I thought was important. And I saw it as a real opportunity. And, unfortunately, I was really good at it. You know, I recognized that music was a really powerful tool to bring young people together. And to kind of speak to them. So I formed a band, one of America's first white power bands, and the first American band to ever leave the United States and play in Europe in 92. And it brought all the young people around town together because it was a lower middle class, kind of working class neighborhood. You know, people were unemployed, and it was easy to kind of appeal to these kids from broken homes and get them to all come out and hang out at a concert and drink beer and be around girls. And before we knew it, you know, we had 100 kids or, you know, 150 kids from the neighborhood hanging out on a regular basis and shaving their heads. And eventually merged that small, very infamous skinhead group called the Chicago Area Skinheads into the Hammer Skin Nation, which is now probably the most violent and deadly skinhead, neo-Nazi skinhead group in the world.
Oh, no. There's a lot there to just even digest, but I'm wondering, what is the relationship like with your family at this point? What are your parents thinking as they see you transitioning from a 14-year-old, you know, whatever, into, you know, shaved head and combat boots and punk and this kind of thing? Did they have any clue what's going on? Did you guys have a relationship through this?
You know, my parents were Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and they were working really hard. I saw it as being abandoned. You know, when I needed my parents there, they weren't there, but they were working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, and I didn't recognize that then. So at first, you know, when I was 14, for that first year, maybe I hid it from them pretty well, and they weren't really around to notice. At 15, at 16, when I started to get, you know, brought home by the cops for fighting, that's when they became really alarmed and didn't understand what I was a part of, like most Americans didn't, but they were even further removed because, you know, they had hardly spoke English. So they were very concerned, and I really credit them because they stood by me despite the terrible things that I did and you know, the hell that I put them through as a teenager. They stood by me, and they always really tried to love me and support me no matter what I did.
I mean, so you're this music, you said you found a lot of things through music, and you went over and toured in Germany and you know, performing in cathedrals and whatnot. Are you, during this time when it's going, are you not only like, obviously you're preaching a message, but are you becoming intoxicated with power at this point and being the leader and getting the attention? Does that fit into this too?
100%. I'd gone from a really powerless 14-year-old kid to now somebody who was completely intoxicated on the power that I was getting. And the ideology really started to mean less and less to me than the power did. You know, I had this massive community, this global community that recognized me. I had a local group that was one of the largest groups in the country. You know, I had this band that was selling records all around the world, and I got really drunk with that power until it almost destroyed me.
Now, as you're touring Europe, I mean, how are you organizing the group at this time? Is it more just about the music and throwing out the message? Or are you still managing things back at home, for lack of a better term? Where's your status here?
Yeah, I mean, I was mostly home at that time. We were, you know, poor, broke skinheads, so we didn't really, you know, if we did tours and if somebody would find a venue that would allow us to play or some private land, they were pretty rare. So it was a couple times a year, you know, and everybody from all over the country would gather at these things, so they'd be really big events. But I, you know, locally, we were more of the marketing arm, the recruiting arm. We put out music. We did a lot of recruiting. We had our fair share of violence, but we certainly weren't as violent as some of the groups that were out there. But yeah, that doesn't mean that, you know, we didn't partake in that as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, how you know, we see these movies on TV, and you know, like American History X is the one that comes to you the most, and even your story on paper, you know, sounds very similar to that character. But how
I would agree.
How much violence are you seeing on a daily basis or a weekly basis? And when you're the leader of something like that, do you have like cronies doing these things for you? Do you have planned attacks and whatnot, or is it more of just like where you're there, incidents happen?
You know, we were what I would call, you know, white terrorists. We had violence on a daily basis, whether it was a street fight with, you know, an opposing gang, could have been an inner city gang. But we also, you know, had arsenals of weapons, and we were planning, you know, for a race war, and We're ready to fund our revolution, you know, however we thought we could. And there were there was definitely a lot of talk, you know, about kind of widespread violence like we're seeing today, like these lone wolf attacks, even though I really don't believe in the term lone wolf because they're all influenced by an ideology and a group. Whether they're a member or not does not necessarily mean they're a lone wolf. That's a very rare occurrence. But yeah, I mean, we would have done, we were stupid enough to have done anything at that point to prove that we were right because we were so deep into it. And I mean, there was one point in 1993, I believe, when Muammar Gaddafi had sent somebody from Libya to meet with me because they wanted to fly me to Tripoli to fund our fight against the Jews in America.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, luckily I didn't go. I was still, you know, a proud American, and I didn't want to work with that. But I mean, that's something that's been happening for years, and I've been predicting for years too that it's just a matter of time before we see the far right and ISIS-inspired extremists working together. Because if you think about it, well, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to a lot of people because they really don't like each other. If you think about who they hate more than each other, that is the Jew, and they will put aside their differences to work together to try and eliminate that problem that they think exists.
Wow, that's deep and dark. Now, as you're in the middle of this, when you're 19 years old, you have your first child. About how far through, say, either through your wife's pregnancy or when the child gave birth, did you feel you had a little change?
The child gave birth?
No, the wife.
He had an amazing child. First one ever. It's like, yeah. I gotta give this stuff up.
That was a huge turning point for me. Absolutely, probably the biggest and certainly one of the first. You know, when I was 19 years old, I got married and we had our first kid, and at 21, we had our second son. You know, at 19 years old, holding my, you know, baby boy, it helped me reconnect with the innocence that I lost at 14 years old and what could have been. And suddenly it challenged that narrative of what is my identity and who is my community and what is my purpose. My identity, you know, was a leader of this notorious, you know, group. But now I was also a father, and my community, which had been this, you know, this family, this that I'd recreated around me, was now my real family. And my purpose, you know, saving the white race, that was less important than supporting my family. So I really had a major internal struggle with my family winning out eventually, but too late, because I didn't leave the movement fast enough before I lost my wife and my children in a divorce, because they weren't a part of the movement.
Obviously your wife has to know something about what's going on. Was she supportive of it, or was she just in love with you and not, I don't know, like, how did that relationship work?
You know, I had a pretty bad reputation, and it took me months and months and months to even try and get a date with this girl. She put me off, you know, for a long time, until finally she gave in and went on a date with me, even though she despised what I was about. Jeez. And eventually, you know, we fell in love, and I was certainly different around her than I was around the guys. You know, I was kind of my true self around her. I was, you know, compassionate and empathetic, and I loved her a lot, and she hated it. She hated every bit of me being involved. And I did start pulling back because of her and because of the kids. And what I did to do that was, you know, I kind of was still the leader, but I kind of handed off the street stuff to other people. And I opened a record store so that I could both stay in the movement by selling white power music that I was importing from Europe and also support my family. And that was kind of the compromise that I thought would work. And what I didn't expect were two things. One, I didn't leave the movement fast enough. And while I opened this record store, my wife left with the kids. And two, that the people I started to meet at this record store, because I was also selling metal and hip hop and punk rock and other music, you know, the people that I thought I hated came in, and instead of punching me or breaking my windows or spray painting my store, they came in, even though they knew who I was, and they showed me compassion. And these were the people that I least deserved it from at a point when I least deserved it. And that's what really allowed me to change.
Now, let me ask you, you're obviously, like, you know personally that your views are shifting, like you said, and your thoughts are shifting and your ideals are shifting. But yet you're still, you know, the head of a movement, whatever, running a store, selling an awful message. Is this how are you dealing with this personally when the door is closed and you're not around your, you know, the other skinheads and whatnot? Is this like inner turmoil going on and kind of figuring out what the hell you're going to do from here?
Massive, because I was so scared to give up that identity and that community because of the power that went along with it. And I was scared to be meaningless again, that I stayed in. But behind closed doors, you know, I struggled with that because I really was losing the ideology. I was questioning it very heavily. And, you know, I wanted to be there for my family, but I also struggled with giving up my other family and my other identity. And that's really one of the reasons why in 2009, we decided to start Life After Hate to help people make that transition. Because everybody that comes to us thinks they're the only person that's ever done this. And once they find out that there are other people that have gone through this transformation and this change, we have, you know, over 100 people now since we've launched that we've helped bring together who are all formers. You know, it's easier to do with a community, with that new community. And you know, we really try and support them as much as possible through the process.
Now, did the group notice you were changing in any way? Were they starting to question you, or were you in any danger in the early stages when you were thinking about your ideology that they might go against you or even attack you in some way?
Yeah, you know, I think for the most part, most people feared me that were part of my group. But towards the end, when I really started to pull away, there were definitely people who were not happy about that. And when I decided to leave, finally, there were some people that were very unhappy about that, not just locally, but even nationally and internationally. You know, I was pretty lucky that there weren't a lot of threats of violence back then. You know, I tried to. When I left the movement, I went through a period of 5 years after I'd lost everything. I lost my record store, which was my livelihood, because I closed it because I didn't want to sell this white power music anymore, and it was 75% of my revenue. I lost my wife and children. I lost my community, which I had spent 8 years building, and my identity. I didn't have a great relationship with my parents, which was my fault. So for 5 years, I tried to outrun who I was. So, you know, they had a hard time catching up with me. But I also had a hard time waking up every morning and not committing suicide. Because even though I was treating other people with a ton of respect and I completely abandoned my ideology, I still had this thing inside of me that I was never able to get out because I was so scared of being judged like I judged other people. Until finally, you know, I decided at somebody's urging who saw how desperate I was that I do that. And when I started to talk about it, not only did I start to feel better and be a better father and be a better employee and just be a better person, but I also people couldn't believe that who I was talking about was actually the person that was standing in front of them, which was, you know, pretty powerful for me. So yeah, it was, you know, it was a really long process. I didn't just wake up one morning and decide not to do what I was doing. And it was even harder to walk away.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking the whole time. I mean, you have a book and whatnot. I'm thinking, how long is this process of you know, reforming yourself and changing yourself, struggling with what's going on inside? And how are you dealing with, like, the guilt? I'm assuming there's guilt of the things you've done or the things you've said, the people you've influenced. How do you deal with that? Are you dealing with it by helping people moving forward? Do you go back and like, try to erase some of the things you've done in some way? How do you deal with the past that you did have?
Yes and yes to both your questions. I mean, I definitely go back and when I can, you know, try to make amends for what I've done. And, you know, I've been speaking about my past now for almost 15 years, right. Almost 20 years, actually. And, you know, I've become a bit of a gardener. You know, I planted a lot of seeds of hate back in those days, and I'm still pulling the weeds out every day for those seeds that I planted. So, you know, I know that my life's mission, because I'm one of the few people on earth who's kind of lived through it and understands what I've been through and is committed to helping other people leave. You know, I want to help people understand that they don't have to go down that negative path, that there's something that's broken that they're filling that void with. They hate other people because there's something about themselves that they hate. They're projecting. And I want to try and help them understand what that is and fix that so that they don't have to hate other people. And in fact, that they can enjoy the diversity, because it's something that really is America.
When you work to combine these communities together, do you ever see like a pushback from people? Because it seems like this age, there's been a lot less of forgiveness from the past. It's not, okay, I've done my time, I've reconciled, I'm a better person. It seems like people want to still say, oh, you said this, oh, you did that. I mean, we just had the Bill Maher incident, yeah, as well. Is it hard to, do you get pushback from like the other side, if you will?
You know, there's that rare occasion where somebody will say, you know, once a Nazi, always a Nazi, or, you know, I don't believe people like that can change. And, you know, I can tell you, I've met hundreds of people who've gone through amazing transformations. And I'm not talking about just 16-year-old kids. I'm talking about people who, you know, have been hardened in prison and found their way out in prison. People who grew up in Klan families and, you know, had that rhetoric forced down their throat from the day they were born and found their way out. You know, all I can do is keep doing what I'm doing and what I've been doing for the last 20 years. And that's to show people that that's not the right path. And, you know, not worry too much about what people think. But when somebody does say, you know, I don't believe you've changed, I say, you know, I think you're right. I haven't changed. I'm still that person I was born to be. I got sidetracked for 8 years and I found my way back. So,
Now let me ask you something. You mentioned tattoo removal, helping people, you know, get tattoos removed. What about yourself? As far as tattoos you've gotten, and you know, they mean so much when it comes to these, you know, these hate groups and whatnot. It's almost like a rite of passage. Have you worked on getting removed, or do you wear them, you know, as a reminder? What is your personal feeling on that?
I've gotten all of my previous tattoos that were associated with the movement covered up, okay, by new tattoos, with the exception of one. And that's a band that I have around my left forearm that for most people is pretty innocuous. It's a string of Scandinavian Nordic runes, like Viking runes. Mm-hmm. And the movement people have kind of co-opted the Viking culture as their own, because they see it as like, you know, this white warrior culture. So Vikings and Norse mythology were really important to us in the movement. So I was actually going to get that one covered up. And about 8 years ago, I was walking down the street some guy walked up to me and he's like, and, you know, you wouldn't know what it was unless you were in the movement. And this guy walks up to me and he's like, hey, bro, nice tattoo, white power. And I just kind of looked at him and I said, hey, bro, let's talk. And it was my first intervention, actually. Huh. So, you know, it's one of those things where the tattoo isn't offensive to most people. I've left it there as kind of a calling card, almost a sign of, you know, like a bridge between me and the people that I work with. It obviously doesn't mean the same thing that it did to me, you know, 22 years ago. You know, it definitely helps kind of establish a rapport with people. So for now, at least, I've decided to leave it. But everything else has been covered up.
Hmm. Now, I know you did some reporting for the last presidential election. I kind of want to ask you, now, obviously, we've seen some stuff where some white supremacists were backing behind Donald Trump, but it just seemed, I'm trying to figure out, is it hard to kind of, when you look at these people, qualify the others who voted for Trump or is it kind of hard to separate the two if anybody wants to have, like, an honest bias on figuring out this presidency right now?
You know, I really, it's none of my business who anybody voted for. And if people voted for Trump, that is their right to do so. And I don't have any ill will towards them. I would have loved to have seen it go another way. And to classify every Trump supporter as a racist or a neo-Nazi, I think is completely wrong. I mean, we can't adopt the same values that the people that we despise use. However, there are definitely a lot of people, and I would say the vast majority of the movement, which is quite large these days, did support Donald Trump. And they did so because a lot of the things that he said and is still saying really mirror in a slightly more palatable way, in a slightly better marketed way, the same ideas that they push. You know, xenophobia, not wanting to let people in from other countries, you know, not wanting to help refugees, and things like a travel ban focused on, you know, a specific religion. The appointments that he's made, people like Bannon and Stephen Miller and even Gorka are highly, highly questionable. Those folks, you know, Bannon, who was the ran Breitbart, is probably one of the extreme right's biggest propaganda machines. The stuff that they put out, a little bit more polished than what we used to put out, is saying the exact same thing in many cases. It's spreading conspiracy theories and these false ideas about certain groups. You know, Stephen Miller's had association with white nationalists in the past. Gorka, you know, he's done some really stupid things that, you know, would kind of cement his association with European far-right groups. So that's questionable. You know, if you were to ask me if Trump is either a racist or created this racist storm, I would say no to both of those. I think Trump is an opportunist, and I think that there are people really manipulating him, despite what, you know, he wants you to think. And right. Two, you know, did he create the racism? Of course not. Racism existed since day one that America was founded. And, you know, that white majority has always tried to maintain their supremacy over everybody else. And that's a class thing, against lower class whites, against people of color, against, you know, immigrants. You know, it's racism existed. What the election did was it just kicked over a bucket of gasoline on all the fires that already existed, and, you know, emboldened people, because now, you know, the real haters, the people who are willing to be violent, are willing to be extreme, you know, find comfort in the fact that the administration partly is supporting what they're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying that when the whole election was going on, Trump doesn't, whatever, Trump, you know, he's whatever. But what's scary to me is exactly kind of what you were just saying. It's the people that felt emboldened and awakened by, you know, either taking a piece of a message and using it to be something, you know, way more, probably way more worse than what even he meant. But, you know, yeah. Trump to me is always the guy, you know, I've said this before on the show, but, it, you know, as a comic, he would be one of the hardest guys to follow, because he'll say anything in a room to get the, you know, to get the crowd riled up. Like, he'll win a crowd over almost anywhere.
Right.
You know,
I mean, he's already proven that he can say just about anything and get away with it. So, I mean, yeah, you're right. Yeah, and it's really unfortunate, because I think, you know, some of the things that I've been seeing with the trends happening with the new administration, like there's this program called the Countering Violent Extremism Program that started under President Obama, and it was to empower communities to help people in their community that they think might be becoming, you know, extremists, you know, not just Muslim communities, but even, you know, white communities and rural communities and cities. What happened, actually, you know, that involved us specifically, because we were part of this community, is we applied for our first government grant because we wanted to develop an online intervention program, because so much of this propaganda and radicalization is happening online almost exclusively these days. We wanted to develop a program, and we actually were awarded a $400,000 grant in January, about a week before President Obama left office. We got a really nice email and phone call congratulating us. We were chosen among like the hundreds that applied. Then President Trump took office a week later, and immediately after that, there were reports in Reuters and in other news outlets that they were actually going to freeze all the funding. They did freeze all the funding. They pulled our funding. They were going to re-review all the awardees, and that they were actually going to change the program from countering violent extremism and rebranding it as countering radical Islamic extremism, quote unquote, which I think is terrifying, because what that tells me is it's a counterintelligence operation then, and not a community-led approach. And it's counterintelligence focusing on specific communities and possibly radicalizing them further, because now they feel targeted, and now they feel angry, and now they feel infiltrated, and they don't trust the people that are supposed to be helping them. It's a real shame if that actually comes to fruition.
That's scary, man. I mean, just that whole thing is scary.
But I want idea of removing white extremism from the focus of domestic extremism, I think, is a huge mistake, because, you know, apples to apples, white extremists kill more people and have killed more people since 9/11, more than any foreign or domestic terrorist group combined. And that, to me, is the real domestic terror threat that we're not talking about.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, being, like you said, close to 20 years out of this, what is the most, rewarding thing? Like, you've dealt with so much. I'm sure you still deal with, some of the past. But what is, the most rewarding thing you feel you have done to reverse some of the stuff or change your ways? Or was there a certain group of people that took you in and helped you that changed your viewpoints? Or, is there a certain person you helped that really made you feel like, okay, I'm on the right path finally?
You know, I think it builds every day, because every day I'm working with somebody new who's either asked for help, or, a family member has asked for help, and working with them because I really understand them. I was that person that I served at one point in my life, and helping them kind of go down their own path to find out, what their destination or journey should be, is the most rewarding thing. And pulling these weeds that I keep talking about, is something that I think I'm going to do for the rest of my life, because not only did I hurt the people that I was attacking back in the past, I hurt the people that I recruited, because I brought them into a life and all. Probably the most important thing is to continue to do what I do.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you. I just wonder, are you still into music now? And have you thought about making possibly like a band to kind of reverse of with your new ideologies? Come up with music that's more inspiring and trying to bring people together.
Man, I'm 43 years old, and while I would love to get back on a stage,
that's a perfect mid-level crisis thing, though, right there. We're starting a band.
I still collect guitars, and I still have my equipment, and while I would love to play for my boys who've never seen me perform live, I don't know, man. I don't know if I've got it in me to do that anymore. But I would, I think I could pull one comeback show out of my pocket and then fall over and call an ambulance.
Oh, come on now. It's easy. We can make pop song. You're thinking like punk rock still. We can auto-tune you. We could do all sorts of things now.
Yeah, you want me to write a pop song is what you're saying.
100%.
How about country? I could write a country song now.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. But what are we doing now? What projects are you working on? Where can people go and check out what you're doing? What is your relationship with your family like now?
It's amazing. My kids are now 24 and 22 years old. They live right down the street. We see each other pretty frequently, as much as, kids that are in their 20s want to see their parents. My parents still live in the same house, and I see them. My mom calls me way too much, but she hasn't learned how to text message yet, so I'm all good there. And, you know, things are great. I've never been happier. You know, I'm married. I've been married for 15 years now. And, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better life after going through what I've been through. I'm really lucky. As far as projects, you know, I still am promoting my book, Romantic Violence. And I speak all over the world. I've recently traveled to Denmark and Turkey and Sweden and Norway and Bulgaria and Hungary and Slovakia. And I love doing that, because what I find is, you know, they understand my story. They can relate to my story no matter where they are, because I'm really not talking about a specific ideology that they may even be dealing with as a country, but I'm talking about the human needs and the road that I went down that almost everybody could potentially go down as well. So yeah, it's been a really great journey, and I've got some cool things on the horizon that I'm working on, like a TV show. And we'll see what happens, I guess, in the future.
Yeah, and that TV show is all about getting you back on stage, right?
maybe
American Idol with Christian Peach.
If you guys send me some of those beers I keep here, you guys cracking open over there, maybe. You,
all right, Stone Rippers. Okay.
Well, I mean, at least you've been listening. But where can people go and check you out, like, or send a message to you? Maybe they heard this, or they're into your message and whatnot, and contact you a little bit further.
You know, I'm on all the social media platforms, Twitter and Facebook. You can go to my website. It's christianpicciolini.com. Good luck spelling that.
Even that's what Google's for.
Yeah, even easier than that, you can go to lifeafterhate.org or exitusa.org. And on both of those places, you should be able to find links to my stuff. So,
I guess one more question for you, Christian. With all the talks that you've done with other people and trying to get them out of the way, if you could go back in the past and talk to your 14-year-old self, what do you think would have been the first thing you would have said to yourself to try to keep you away from what you were about to do?
You know, it's funny that you say that, because that's actually my next book. My next book is going to be a letter to my former 14-year-old self from me. So I won't give too much away. But what I'll
read
say
the book,
is,
please. Yeah, page one.
Probably a couple of years out. But what I'll say is, you know, there are people out there that want to manipulate your vulnerabilities. Be strong enough to know that even though you feel like you're on the outside, so does everybody else. And that means you're really on the inside. So just find a way to amplify your passions, find people who will support you in positive ways, because there are people out there that will do that, and just make good happen, because that's really the way the world works.
Amazing, man. Really awesome talking to you. You know, you're so well spoken, and like, you have such a good message. It's like, I mean, even you, probably for you mostly, but it's amazing to probably think about the differencing and how polarizing you were one way and how polarizing you can be the other way in just one lifetime. And obviously, you made the right choice, my friend.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, man. It's been a long journey, and I know, you know, people have probably had a harder journey than me, but you know, anybody can change. Anything is possible, and don't give up on people.
Now, I was wondering if you could help me real quick. How do I stop hating New York Ranger fans?
You should first become a Blackhawks fan.
You had a good run. I'm a Devils fan. We had our run too. We had our run.
I'm a Flyers fan. You know, we're still waiting.
We're waiting the run.
Listen, man, you guys are the Bruisers, and even though you guys haven't won since what, the 70s, 60s, or whatever,
75.
Yeah, 75. You know, you guys still got the reputation as the, you know, the tough guys on the ice.
You don't have to charm him. You can just rub it right in.
No, I insist on charming myself.
Please charm me, Christian. You've been you've been a blast, man. And good luck with everything you're doing in the future.
Thanks, man. You guys too.
That was really cool, man.
Really awesome. Really. And I got him off from seeing a random video on Facebook about a guy turning around his life. I'm like, that's an awesome story. Let me see if I can get a hold of him.
It's amazing. Sometimes I'll sit in front of, like, the computer. I'm like, okay, who do I want to reach out to now? And, like, nothing comes to me. Like, I'm like, And then
then it's like you said, you see like a little video or a clip. I'm like, ah, okay, let's try to reach a guy. Even those tag guys last week, I just saw a little video. I'm like, these guys would be fun to talk to. And they turned out to be fun to talk to.
But absolutely.
It's just a really, it really reminded me of like American History X, the real story. Like, I want, you know.
It's incredible. It's
pretty incredible. But
and how old is that movie? Like 20 years?
It's probably pushing. I would say, was that late 90s that came out?
Yeah, and it's still a legitimate situation we have nowadays. It's amazing.
Let's see. American History X.
That was like Norton's like big breakthrough movie.
Yeah, 98.
Wow.
So 20 years next year. That was when Norton put, when he was just like, I am the best character actor ever at the time. Mm-hmm. American History X, and then it was like Fight Club, and then it was like, he put, even though the score wasn't that good, he played a really cool role in this. Like, he did all these, like, definitely, like, extreme characters. That's what made me fall in love with him. Like, he was my favorite actor back then. He's bottomed out a little bit. Like, I feel like he does a lot other stuff than acting now.
Yeah, well, he pisses off too many people. That's what basically happens. He has his vision, and anybody gets away with it, he'll just piss him off.
Yeah, and he seems like he just picks and chooses things to do. Like, he doesn't seem like he's like...
It seemed like he's happy he didn't get the Hulk role for Avengers, you know?
Yeah.
It'd be like, you'd be taking away stuff from me.
He just never seemed like... The Hulk. It just didn't seem like a match to me. The movie's okay. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it.
Yeah. It's hard to do a Hulk movie. I was talking to a buddy. He absolutely loved the Hulk growing up. I said, you know, you look at Spider-Man, you go, oh, man, I can't wait for him to go against Doc Ock or Vulture.
I'm not super excited about this one. I thought I would be...
I'm happy. I mean, for what I saw him in the Captain America Civil War, I'm happy.
Good. He was good.
He's back to what he is, a young kid who has to have superpowers and trying to deal with
it. I think I'm just sick of Spider-Man. I think that's all it is. It's just I'm sick of Spider-Man. Like, go away for 20 years and come back. You know, like, I'm just another Spider-Man reboot. Here we go. You know, what's this?
Well, that's Sony screwing it up. Yeah. But as I was saying, like, Superman, you're like, oh, I can't wait to see him against Lex Luthor or Doomsday. You see the Hulk... It's like, his biggest enemy is people.
Or himself, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to...
I like that they're throwing him in the Thor movie, though, which looks pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that is canon in the comic books.
I love the Hulk. I love what they've done with the Hulk. He's so awesome in the Avengers. He's, like, the best part. Mm-hmm. I, like, get excited. Like, I remember me and Alex went to see the Avengers. I'm like squeezing him and Hulk. I'm like, Hulk's here! Hulk's here! Here we go! Hulk smash, baby! And then, I don't know. He's just... Like,
get angry. Do it. Do it. Do it.
When he just punches Thor, like, that's...
That's
such a good movie. The first one is
Puny
so Hogan. Good.
Yeah. Or Puny God, that's what he says.
Yeah, where he takes Loki and just... I love what they did with... I think they finally, got him right. Like,
Norton did it well.
The one, Hulk where he's, like, jumping over, like, the Grand Canyon and, like... That was so... I don't even remember...
He was fighting a lightning monster. It's like, what? What are you doing, Nick Nolte?
That's also the name of Metallica's next album, Fighting the Lightning Monster.
You're welcome.
We're back again. And so am I.
Scott Stapp, stop coming here.
We're gonna do the cast. Gonna sing tonight. Come on, podcast with me. So come on, join me in God's conversation.
This is like the worst Broadway play ever.
Come on, join me. Join me on this podcast. Let's get Scott Stapp on.
We tried that once.
I know. He was actually on Opie and Anthony, like, right before they broke. Or maybe it was just Opie. I don't remember what it was. He had, like, a ton of drug problems and stuff, too. Yeah. It was pretty
good. They all do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I know. But he was, like, the God guy. Like, mm-hmm. You know, which, usually the God guys had problems.
Oh, yeah. Like exactly.
But I wanted to tell... Susan Robb, who is one of our sponsors here... who represents Paul Templer. And now a couple episodes ago, we had Kim Ward and Susan on. They were talking about that documentary series about going to Nepal and whatnot to climb Mount Everest and doing these interviews and show and whatnot. So they, Paul and this woman, Kim, went over. So I get this message. Let me me get it right here. Okay. So I get this message. I got an update on the Paul. Gonna blow your mind.
Okay.
The plane.
It's a country.
The plane Paul and Kim were waiting for to take them to the airport with a really ill little boy they promised to help crashed into a mountain, and the pilot and co-pilot died.
Wow.
Yeah. So the small plane was on the way to pick up Paul and this woman, Kim,
mm-hmm.
and crashed into a mountain.
Huh. Hmm. So how's the show going?
Yeah. I was like, I don't really know what to say to that, but it's pretty crazy.
When you're on Nepal News, can you mention verbal shenanigans?
When you're doing an interview of how sad you are, can you put the T-shirt on?
Yeah.
It's terrible. We've crossed the line several times
today. Yeah, last couple days. Yeah.
It's summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking the other day that I was looking through the episodes on – like some of the things, some numbers and stuff like that, just checking like what was getting listens and whatnot. And I went back, the one where we interviewed the sleep, the guy who tried to stay awake. For,
yep.
And it got me thinking, I for years I remember this story watching these Russian sleep experiments. Did you ever hear this?
No.
Okay. I always like to like, I don't know, I think sometimes bringing up like creepy stories is kind of fun. So I'm going to tell you the story of Michael Berlew's childhood. It all started as a toothbrush. If you ever write a memoir, that should be like the name of it.
Diaries of a Living Toothbrush. Michael Berlew.
So, I forget if this has audio, but we're going to check. So, do you know about the Russian sleep experiment? And if it doesn't have audio, I'll read it.
Okay. Well, you might as well go ahead. I'm not aware with it.
Go ahead. Okay.
Ooh.
Oh. Oh, come. Well, I'll read it. Okay. So researchers in 1940 took five prison inmates. Turn that down a little bit. all right. Now I got to restart. I missed my spot. Okay. So research. Damn it. I lost my spot again. Researchers in the 1940s took five prison inmates and locked them in a chamber with a special gas to keep them awake.
Ooh.
They wanted to see the effects of prolonged sleep deprivation. And promised the subjects their freedom if they can go 30 days without sleep.
Wow.
After several days, some prisoners began screaming endlessly. Others blocked a one-way mirror so the researchers could no longer watch them. Then the screaming stopped. 3 days went by without a sound from inside the chamber.
Uh-oh.
The researchers addressed them via the intercom. They were coming in and told the inmates to lie flat on the floor. One of the voices answered, "We no longer want to be freed." The researchers opened the chamber anyway. One of the subjects was dead and torn to shreds.
Oof.
With chunks of his body stuffed into the floor drains.
Oh.
The other four subjects were mutilated to the brink of death. Terrified at the sight of them, one member of the team opened fire on the prisoners. Before killing the last inmate, the researcher asked a single question, "What are you?" The subject responded, "Have you forgotten so easily? We are you. We are the madness that lurks within you all, begging to be free at the very moment in your deepest animal mind. We are what hide you from in your beds every night." The researcher, satisfied with this answer, shot the last remaining subject in the heart.
Interesting.
Hmm. That's pretty bad.
Messed up. How many days did they go in?
I don't know. I saw the video on this before, so I just played the video. I don't know. It could be a hoax.
Mm.
It could be real.
I mean, 30 days, that's close to three times longer than...
I guess that was the goal they were going for. So, like, let's see. Let's Google Russian sleep experiment. I might get some weird websites to pop up.
And it's porn.
The Russian sleep experiment, okay. Yep, in 1940. So a bunch of things pop up. Now, I'm like, I have ADD and I'm kind of like dumb. So I see it.
I want to read it. Like, I don't really want to go check it out if it's really true. I mean, I'm not going to go research anything.
I can read it.
I mean, the rest of the internet does it. So, Donald Trump freed everyone. He's the best. Obama killed the kitten. Like, but I don't know,
after
man.
After 20 days without sleep, he said, Kofefe.
Kofefe. But, yeah, man, pretty.
Yeah, that's a little dark there.
A little dark.
If it's true, it's dark.
A little dark. And, of course, they, like, put the creepy music and creepy images and stuff like that. And, I don't know, man. It was funny because I was going over, like I said, I was looking at, what did this episode get? I'm like, and just, like, something reminded me of something I saw a long time ago. I'm like, I got to find it again.
Mm.
And, it was there. All right, I got one more.
All right.
All right. All right, all right. All right.
I'm Paul on behalf of Graveyard Ship. This is the story of a woman frozen solid who miraculously escaped death. Now, Jean Hillard was a 19-year-old woman. She was driving home in the midnight hours on December 20th, 1980, in rural Minnesota, when her car skidded off the road. Shaken and alone, she was unable to restart the car, and with little choice, she began walking to a friend's house. The gentleman's name was Wally Nelson, who lived about 2 miles away. Now, she nearly made this trip. She actually ended up being 15 feet from his door until she collapsed from hypothermia. Over the course of 6 hours, her body became completely frozen as she lied still in the snow, negative 22 degree temperatures. Now, Wally found her that following morning, lying in the snow at 7 a.m. She was so frozen, he had to load her diagonally into his car and drive her to Foster Hospital.
I picture, like, those people who have to, like, you see them coming from Home Depot, and you're like, oh, my God, like, rent the truck. Like, where they got the... you know, they got plywood tied to the... One time I tied plywood to my old SUV. And I had like three pieces, and I guess I didn't tie the top one down enough, and half of it just flew, snapped off in the highway. That's how I picture this woman's body. Or people putting a kayak into the car, like it just doesn't fit.
Now, did you go back for that, or did you just hit the
I just hit the gas. I was like, I'm out of here.
didn't see nothing.
Didn't hit any cars.
General officer, just me with my 2 2x4s.
I love my. I got 2.5 pieces from.
That's all I need. Why would it gotta be like that?
Why is it all jagged? It's a weird room. It's a weird design.
I went to True Value. I should have went to Lowe's. I'm sorry.
All right, so it's frozen woman.
Now, one of the nurses there, Nurse Dorothy Killian, was on record and saying she said she was shocked. Her face was completely white, just this ashen death look. They hooked her up to the monitor, getting barely a heartbeat. Severely frostbitten, her blackened legs wouldn't move or bend, and a hypodermic needle couldn't even penetrate her skin. Wow. Doctors assessed that even if she could survive, she would likely have brain damage and her legs would need to be amputated. The lead doctor on the scene, Dr. George Sather, said she was, quote, just like a piece of meat out of a deep freeze. They wrapped her in an electric blanket, and she slowly began to thaw. Now, after 2 hours, her body went into violent convulsions. She wasn't through the woods yet. There was hope, but brain damage was still a possibility. Then, Jean regained consciousness and saw her family standing around her. 49 days later, doctors weren't able to explain how this all happened and how Jean Hillard walked out of the hospital, having made a complete recovery with no permanent damage from the event. I'm Paul on behalf of Graveyard Shift, and this has been a story of how a woman seemingly survived being frozen to death.
I mean, the most interesting thing is she didn't get, had to get any amputations. If anything, I figured like fingertips or stuff like that, they usually turn purple. And
yeah, and what's even more interesting is that no one ever saw this prequel to Encino Man.
Oh, yeah. No. Pauly Shore's just sitting back going, oh, why'd you let go of that script? I was making a comeback.
Yeah, again, is it true? I'm not 100% sure. I'm not going to do the research to figure it out. So if anybody listening...
The Shenanigans investigates.
If anybody listening wants to do it and send us this is fake, that's fine. Mm-hmm. In fact, we encourage them a little bit of interaction. But I mean, you always hear like a lot of movies start like that. Someone's frozen. They come back. Austin Powers.
Mm-hmm.
Captain America.
That's pretty much it.
Walt Disney... Don't they say he was frozen?
Well, his head's frozen somewhere.
Is that really true?
That's what they say. They say.
I know. I've heard like that since I was a kid.
Fad where they say just freeze ahead, it's going to be good. Ted Williams, same thing.
Would you want to be frozen?
The whole body? I mean, I guess if there's a chance, why not? I mean, I'm not going to pay money to do that. You know?
Let's say.
I watched Futurama. It looks cool.
Let's say you. The doctors came to you and they're like, look, Mike. You are guaranteed, okay, to live this life to 65, okay? At 65, we're going to freeze you. And technology is going to take about 50 years. But then when you unfreeze, you're going to live like another 150 years. What do you do?
Again, it all boils down to, am I, like, taking away every dime from all my grandchildren and stuff like that to survive, or is it just a readily available thing where...
It's some guy at the winery just came up to you and says, I could do this for you.
Oh, they put me in the slushy machine. That's awesome.
Whee! I don't know. It's a doctor. It's a new cutting-edge treatment. They're paying for it because they are doing the test.
I think I would do it just on the basis of why not. I'm either gonna, it's gonna screw up and I'm gonna die anyway. I mean, I was gonna be dead at 65, or I'm gonna be in the future and I got some more chance. Well, no, of life.
It's a risk. So 65 is when they'd freeze you.
Got it.
So you will die when you have to, when you're gonna die.
All right. So there's a chance I have like another 10 years, or I'm gambling on extending it for 150.
Maybe you live another 20 years, what's 30 years? But you're gambling. Yeah, you're gambling. You're doubling age, down on your life.
Yeah, the general age is 76, I believe. So, in essence, you're thinking you're putting down 11 years on this.
Right. So, you're gambling. There's no guarantee. Gotcha. They tell you.
Gotcha.
It's a tough question.
I guess it depends on if I'm still there with Izzy, if I have kids, if I have grandkids. I'm not going to gamble. I'm going to take what I'm guaranteed to have with them.
Right.
If I'm by myself, I'm a loner.
What if they're like, we'll freeze your whole family? You'll be like a frozen family. You'll be an exhibit at some weird museum.
Cali, too?
Sure. Why not? We'll freeze everything. Okay. So whatever situation you're in, they'll freeze your loved one, too.
I would definitely consider it. Why not?
Yeah. I don't think I could do it, man. Like, I don't know.
Are you worried you can't handle the future?
Yeah. Like, I don't think... I mean, you got to remember, you're waking up in a world that doesn't know you. Mm-hmm. Well, they know you probably, but you don't know them at all.
It's the equivalent to moving to another state, pretty much. That's the way
it's the equivalent of going to. It's like going to Nebraska. It's the same thing.
I will go. What is this, North Dakota?
I like this how you just compared being frozen for a couple dozen years, 10, 50 years, something like that, to going to another state.
Yeah. New experience. That's the way I am. I'm laid back. It's like, all right, let's give it a shot. Whole family's coming with me. All right. We'll be together in the worst case.
Now, what about if you could be sent back in time? Would there be any period in your life that you would go back to? Or would you go back to a time that you were never born in?
I mean, the childhood wasn't anything amazing where I need to live back on. Let me
rephrase my weird question.
Okay.
What if you're your age now, you're the way you are now, you're an adult, sort of, somewhat of an adult. You're in an adult's body, like you are now, and you can go back to any era. You can go live in an era as an adult, as a person. Or you're just cool with what it is now?
Probably not, because going back in time, times are just worse in the past.
You think so?
For the most, I mean, pretty much my biggest gripe in these days is like political correctness and, you know, over obsessive social media. It's not enough where I go, all right, I'm going to go back to the 80s.
I don't know. Like, something, like the age I am now, something seems like cool about my dad's child. Like, when they were like young adults, it seemed like there was a lot less like politically correct things. There was a lot like, I don't know, you could get away with a lot more. The music was good. Like something about like that 70s era seems like it was a good time.
It's probably a fun.
Everyone
time,
worked on their cars, and like cars were nice. And
well, I mean, they still had like terrible. They had no technology. Yeah. They had.
I mean, they had some.
I mean, there was. I mean, we got Vietnam. We got. There's so many factors where I'm just sitting back going. I mean, if you're saying go back for an hour, all right. Live a life? I don't know if I can do that.
I don't know, man. I think I might go back. I think I might go try something else.
Right.
I find
I invented podcasts.
The world we're like in now seems to be pigeonholing to me. Like people are getting worse to me, and I don't know if that's just because I'm getting older, and I think that's what older people do. Like, these young kids. Back in my day, but it seems everything is going to this. Everyone's offended. Everyone's hurt. Everything's like too
sensitive.
And I don't know if there's anything that gets us back to being not like that.
It will be pretty hard. I mean, off the top of my head, I can't think of a scenario where we're going to be changing like that. But that's just with the times. I mean, growing up, parents were complaining how you kids have computers and. We had to look up things in a book, and you'll never know what true knowledge is. Now we're to the point where the knowledge is infinite, and we're just figuring out faster ways to get the knowledge.
What if we humans have done all this before, and we've been eradicated off the earth before, and then we just came back?
Like a circle?
Yeah, like what if, you know, the dinosaurs died, right?
Okay.
What if the humans were... You know, we got a disease, a plague, and the humans are pretty much wiped out, and we almost have to re-evolve again. What if millions of years ago, people were podcasting and texting and video chatting and watching HBO, in their own society, different things.
And so basically, this is happening. Aliens are watching us. They say, this is garbage. They blow up the Earth. Put back a new Earth and say start from scratch.
Right. Like, or no, even like on this planet, like, what if this is like the second time we've been through evolving, like mentally, right? Because humans, you know, we don't check back to that long. Like, think about how much technology has come in 100 years. Think how much technology has come in 15 years. Mm-hmm. Think about it. What the hell were they doing for 10,000, you know, 100,000 years.
Throwing more rocks.
Yeah. What was their
burning
deal?
Witches.
What was the deal? Their technology was making the wheel? The wheel? Come on.
It was a pretty good wheel. I got one.
It just feels like I always wonder, like, hundreds from years from now, people look back at this time in history. Are they going to be like, are they going to call, like, from the early 90s, like the mid 90s to like 2030, whatever it is, the technology like boom, because we have jumped leaps and bounds in just the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, what if this has been done before?
Nobody can redo me, not
per se, like everything's exactly the same, but what if we had technology that allowed us to take this phone and send a message. Maybe they had something else, like an ability to send a message to someone. When people always do talk about like their third eye and other senses.
Yeah, they talk about aliens coming down during the pyramid days. Mm-hmm. No way with their technology they can build pyramids. Could happen. I don't, until we get to that next step and see what's out there. And
okay, let's be honest. We're close to extinction again. You know, a couple bombs get thrown. You know, all right.
Good habit.
What if it wasn't disease? What if bombs or technology destroyed the world and everyone died?
I don't know what you want me to do. It happened.
Well, it probably didn't happen, but maybe it did. Maybe it did. Maybe the dinosaurs have been on this earth several times before.
That'd be crazy.
I think I've been listening
aliens.
To too much Joe Rogan. Yeah. I really think that's what's happening here. But I don't know. I don't like those kind of questions.
Yeah, it's deep. I mean, who knows? I mean, how do you react to something like that if you find out?
I mean,
makes your life even more minuscule if that's true, though.
Well, we are nothing. We are nothing. We are a blip on the radar of the Earth. Think about how old the Earth is. Think about how young humans are. You know, like, you think about ancient Rome, right? That's only a couple thousand years on the Earth's, you know, a couple million years old. And it's flat.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you Some believe that there is groups of people in the United States right now that believe the Earth is flat?
People just want to believe stuff just to, quote unquote, sound smart.
Maybe it's like Christian was saying. They just want to belong to something, so they just jump on the flat Earth.
That's what it pretty much is, because after that one, I forget who it was saying the Earth's flat, like tons of other celebrities come out. No, I can see what he did.
I hate and anything anti-science just blows my mind. I'm like, come on. We had guys without technology that discovered this. Yeah. Plato and Aristotle and all these other guys figured this out with nothing. And yet we're gonna, because we are so bored, we can tweet, yeah, Earth's flat.
Yeah,
just rile people. I don't know. I'm getting way off topic.
Well, it's like I told somebody. It's amazing the rocket they shot up to get the first people on the moon probably didn't have enough technology to equate to your iPhone 7. So
definitely. I wonder what kind of crazy selfies they take in space. Maybe Abigail.
Stop it, Neil.
Maybe Abigail Harrison will be able to tell us on the next time we have run. What else you got? Anything else?
Well, I got a few creepy stories of my own, as you requested for this bit.
I think, once a month we should try to find unique stories.
All right.
It's kind of a nod to a podcast. I tell them Steve Dave has, they do something similar, like, you know, where they bring in, everyone bringing the stories, and I liked it. So
I'm down.
I'm essentially stealing it. But
all right. Shh. You're not supposed to say that on the
Real quick side note, because I'll forget if I don't talk. The podcast I listen to, Invisibilia, it's an NPR podcast. Mm-hmm. It comes out every once in a while, and it's like really, really, really interesting, really good. They were on that podcast thing we saw a while ago. Probably longer than that.
A little longer than that, yeah.
Anyway, they just did a whole thing about this island, this town in the United States, I think it was, where they people live with bears and feed bears, and like how people are afraid of bears, but black bears aren't even like remotely scary, and how like bears are like, when you catch them snarling, is a man-made like reaction to bears and stuff like that. I was like, I even tweeted them today. I said, really jealous of your bear piece. We do a segment called Bear News. Great work, guys. But if anybody, listen to Invisibilia. Very, very fascinating.
Awesome.
But yeah.
All right. So this one, have you heard about the Jersey Watcher?
I do a podcast with them every week.
Oh. So the story is for sale. Large 6-bedroom home in Westfield, New Jersey. 3 bathrooms,
yes,
wood flooring,
yes, I've heard of this. Okay, keep going.
And one unnerving stalker. Soon after Derek and Maria Brodus purchased the Westfield home in 2014, they received a letter from someone who called herself the Watcher. The anonymous individual seemed to be the latest in a long line of family members who obsessed over the Jersey home. My grandfather watched that home in the 1920s, and my father watched it in the 1960s. It's now my time to let it read. More letters arrived once the couple moved in with their 3 children. I am pleased to know your names now and the names of the young blood you have brought me.
I've heard this before.
Another chilling missive message asked, found out what's in the walls yet? The Brodus family has since moved out and sued the home's previous owners for failing to... Let me scroll down. There we go. Sorry about that. For failing to mention it as a pre-existing condition. According to CBS New York, the house is back on the market.
Okay. I've read this or heard someone speak about this before. Definitely creepy. Definitely creepy. Now, first thought, I bet you someone in the present is just messing with them. That's what I think.
I would say
like
that.
The grandfathers.
It's like the Scooby-Doo mystery where it was, oh man, Johnson, but you don't have nothing to do with it. I was trying to get the property.
Yeah. Like someone's obviously writing a very creepy letter, probably for their own personal entertainment. But the thing about the grandfather and stuff watching before, I would bet that's like the made up part of the story.
Mm.
Now he might be actually watching or being weird about things.
Mm-hmm.
a generational thing, watching one house. Why? Why are they watching this house? Watching a house is a really boring activity.
Yeah.
I do it. You know, trust me.
they're just, like, on, like, apartments.com and all. What do you mean it's rented out?
Yeah, like, imagine us just sitting here. We're looking out the window now and just watching that house.
It's a nice house.
I mean, just watching. That's it. Yeah. I'm already bored. Not going to lie. Already bored. Unless the puppy comes out, and then I get a little excited. Yeah. I go, yay.
Maybe the door will open or something.
Yeah. Like, a peeping Tom, like, it takes a lot of commitment.
Hmm.
Okay, is there anything else, like, as, like, evidence that someone was watching it in the past decades, or...?
I didn't have any details with it, but they pretty much said anybody who goes into that house gets these letters.
All right, so then someone's maybe been doing this for quite a while.
Mm.
Now, I wonder if they've probably done some kind of surveillance.
Once I get my loan, I'm going to stop sending those letters.
They're probably, I would assume, have checked the surveillance, like put surveillance on the mailboxes or whatnot, or wherever they're putting the letters.
I mean, you got to think, if it was naturally sent through the mail, they could find out who did it. And
that's pretty creepy, man. Like, you get that letter. How do you, like...
I was about to ask, like, you move into this place, you get that letter, and I'll have you check the walls.
Yeah.
How long do you stay here?
Yeah, I guess you don't. I mean, like...
Or do you, like, get a gun and just...
But it did give me an idea. I really like the house down the block.
Mm. And that's true.
It ain't going for sale anytime soon, but
it's got a nice yard. I'll send some letters too.
Just a few letters. That's it. Yeah, I mean, like, I think I might be able to get over it, but, like, I think of, like, my girlfriend. She gets scared. She couldn't even watch Get Out.
Yeah, you know, and it's not a scary movie.
It was quirky.
Like, it was creepy,
yeah.
But it's not scary.
Yeah. Or anything scary, she gets freaked out. Imagine her, like, being home, and that thought of, like, something's in the wall, someone's watching. You get that letter with Izzy. Do you take that letter and you just fucking shove it right in the garbage?
Oh, she would not. What's in the mail? Nothing.
More bills.
Coupons. I don't need this. Screw that.
Right into the garbage. And then you think about it on your own. Like, oh, I think we got to get out of here.
Exactly.
I wouldn't be comfortable with it. How can you be? Would you buy a house where someone was killed in?
Like, how recently we talking? Like, but, no, seriously. Like, yeah, the house is open because somebody got murdered here or somebody died in here 20, 30 years ago.
Good question. All right, let's do both scenarios, okay?
I mean, just murdered, that's, I don't think I could make that move. I mean, it would have
what
to be
if
the most
it's like
insane,
the best price ever.
That's what
it's
I'm
like
about.
Four bedroom,
be
beautiful
most,
backyard.
If it was for the most insane price ever, and even worst case where I'd say, okay, if I get the heebie-jeebies, flip it immediately, I might do it.
What if one of the Duke brothers owned it?
Duke boys, you mean?
Duke, sorry. Okay. Oh, but what if someone was murdered 30 years ago?
I think I can handle it. Just be like, it happened.
Now, do you think you buy a house that someone was murdered 30 years ago? It's not haunted, but you think your brain starts to play with you?
Oh, it will play games.
No.
Believe me, it would play games, and probably I'd have a high electric bill just keeping lights on in certain places, but I think in the end...
But the pool's great.
The view, man. Oh, my God.
That Lazy Susan, amazing. Yeah, I think I feel like I wouldn't be bothered, but then all of a sudden, like I said, I'm watching a movie by myself, and I hear a weird sound. I'm like, oh, crap. Mm-hmm. They're back. You know, like, yeah. Isn't that amazing? Like, someone can die even of, like, natural causes, and people sometimes want to know, like, did someone die in this house? Or
right. Well, going back, I mean, my grandmother died
right
in my house.
My grandmother.
I lived there for another, I was, like, 14, so I was, like, 5-6 years, and I didn't think for one sec, oh my god, grandma's ghost is gonna be in here.
Yeah. My grandmother died in my mom's house, and my sister, I think I've mentioned this to you before. My sister's always been the one out of the three of us that's like, one, she's a girl and she's like afraid, because all girls are afraid, am I right? But
vaginas.
always afraid of the basement, like run up the basement. Mm-hmm. Still to this day, her husband is a police officer, and he works, you know, nights sometimes, and she'll go stay at my parents sometimes, and they own a home now, She'll sometimes stay with my parents, like, because she doesn't want to be alone. But she was always the one that was, like, she had these weird, like, spiritual kind of, like, memories. Like, she remembers, like, something my grandmother said to her when she was, like, 4 years old. Like, she remembered these weird things. And she said that she would, every once in a while, hear my grandmother, like, shuffling her feet, like, a couple years after she was dead, like, in her slippers down the hallway. Hmm. Do I believe her? I don't know. It's probably her brain, but...
Yeah, I mean... I don't know. I mean, even if I'm even creeped out or something like that, I just go on the couch, watch some TV, and I doze asleep, and then kind of gets out of my head, and I go back to my regular sleep routine. I'm not going to blink an eye to it.
Yeah.
I mean, if I see, like, the walls bleeding, I might go, all right, time to put it on the market.
Time to get some paint. But, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know how I'd feel, but I think it's one of those things when you're in the situation, you have to kind of figure it out if you would be able to handle it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, at that point, it's like, why invest so much money?
Going back to, like, former podcasts, so the Ghost Podcast. Like, if somebody said, hey, spend a night here in this attic where they
with
say...
With Melissa Allen.
No. Done deal.
New. Yeah. Take the place. Okay.
But, I mean, they talked about, you know, to leave the place and they'll see, like, a ghost of, like, a... I forget, what was it? Like...
Yeah, like some...
Like, revolutionary people?
Yeah, like a guy looking out the window or something like that. Yeah.
Would you just go, I'm in. How much?
Nah.
Nope.
I don't know, man. The older I get, the weirder I'm getting with that kind of stuff. I used to never be, like... Now I'm like, I don't know. Like, I feel... I remember when I was in Scouts, we, weird enough, we had a woman Scout leader at one point. That's when the Scouts were really...
Oh, now you're telling stories.
Really going downhill. Like, she was, like, insisting on being in the Scouts. I go, come on.
Mm-hmm.
It's Boy Scout. Anyway, she was really, like, into, like, Wiccan stuff and all this witch stuff. And she was always all about, like... I remember once she told us, because we were older at the time, we were, like, 18, 17, 18... And she told us this seance story and about not pissing off the dead and drawers moving and stuff like that. And, like, I think I told you one time I was in high school and we went to an abandoned monastery.
Mm-hmm.
Went under the, like, it's supposed to have, like, 7 sub-basements. We were in the one basement. And that was enough for me. Like, I'm like, nah, this isn't for me. This whole weird New Jersey haunted thing. And I'd leave them alone. let the ghost chill. Because I don't... I'm necessarily afraid, but the older I get, I'm like, I'm not stirring up anything that I don't need to stir up.
It's hard to say. Like, when I made that trip out to Augusta, I remember the trip because on the side there's an abandoned church on the side. It's like this huge thing, and we tried to check it out, and it's on private property. Even, like, a cop came by. He was nice. He's like, this is technically trespassing. Right. Can you leave? Sorry, officer. And went about our business, but I was looking for an open door, and Izzy's like, would you really go in? I'm kind of like, I might, like, peek in.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's probably been, I mean, it's been abandoned for a while. I know, like, floorboards can be loose and stuff like that where you can crash through. I'm not going to just, like, walk in, whatever, but something about me is like, yeah, let me play with the devil
it's
tonight.
It's funny, sometimes I'm like, I don't know where I stand on it. I'm like, now, like I said, I think the older I'm getting, the more I'm like, let's just leave the dead alone.
Yeah. I think exploring I'm all for, but, like, spending the night, no.
Yeah. I used to, like, when I was younger, I was all about it. I was like, oh, let's do these haunted things, stuff like that, and no, not into it. All right, you got one more?
Yeah, let's do one more. The cell phone stalkers. Getting a threatening phone call from a stranger,
aka my girlfriend.
But for 3 Washington State families in 2007, the calls became unraveling personal.
Washington,
okay. Yeah. The families received calls at all hours of the night with threats made against the families and pets. It seems that if the anonymous...
Oh, now they've gone too far. I don't care about Grandpa.
Where's Opie? I'm going to fucking kill you.
I will murder a ghost if he touches my dog. I'll figure it out.
I gotta admit, I kind of like to see Obi, like, floating in the air. Something about that would be unique.
Stop it.
It seemed as if the anonymous tormentors were watching quite closely and listening in as well.
Hmm.
Voicemails arrived, playing recordings of the family's private conversations, including one with a police detective. One family member's cell phone would send text messages to friends by itself. The callers knew where the families were, what they were doing, and what they were wearing. Once when one of the victims was at home slicing limes, a call came in from a restricted number, and the voice on the other end said it preferred lemons.
For a second, I was like, why are they so specific about what she was slicing?
When the calls were traced, they led back to the family's own phones. Authorities and cell phone providers were flummoxed by the reports. We're not exactly sure what is being done to these phones, said Sprint spokesman Matt Sullivan. Electron surveillance experts noted.
This explains it all. It was all Sprint service.
Damn this 1% difference.
It just texts me and calls me and knows what I'm doing. This phone's broken.
Electronic surveillance experts noted the ease with which our cell phones can be hijacked, while others suggested the calls may be coming from inside the house, i.e. a disgruntled family member.
Yuck.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
As weird as it sounds, the lime thing would freak me out. If somebody just called up and said, I prefer lemons, like, I'd just be holding on to that knife, just walking around the house.
I can't wait to text you this week.
Stop petting that dog. How did you know? Damn you, Scott.
Wait till I get access to your Furbo one day. And it's mayhem for one day. You're like, what? Yeah, I don't like that, man. That's weird.
That's freaky stuff.
Like, I don't really know what to say. The other one I had more conversation on because I didn't think it was completely true. This one, I don't know where to go with
it. Yeah, it stepped into a new level.
Yeah.
But those are my stories, Scotty.
All right. Yeah, I like that. Let's keep this, let's do that again in the future.
I'm down.
You know, every couple weeks. Not every week. It's not going to be verbal shenanigans spook fest. real quick, before we get it, how is the job search going?
It's getting frustrating in the sense that I'm getting the context, hey, you know, we're going to set you up with a call, blah, blah, blah. And then I don't get it. And then I get to a point where I'm like, all right, because it's some of them, it's a recruiter, some of them is a company. So,
I feel like that's probably one of the main things that beats a lot of people down is the frustration of okay, let's go. Come on.
And that's the thing. And then I get to a point where it's like, do I bug them to keep on giving me updates where they can just get disgruntled and just pretty much like, you know what, you're done? Or do I sit back and just keep on wondering, am I under consideration? Are they going to call me? Are they still interested? And that's the hardest thing right now, just even kind of deciphering as they go, hey, we're interested, but they're not exactly saying, here's my timetable.
So nothing great yet.
A lot of leads, but again, it's all, will you tell me it's over, or is it still happening, or what's your timeline?
Yeah. Now, if you, take what you actually have skills in, but if you could do anything, what would you do?
Something with sports, probably, like a sportscaster or a reporter, something like that.
Yeah.
I just generally enjoy it. I mean, just as after we went to the soccer game, just this past week, I've been so into soccer. I watched the U.S.-Mexico game. I was watching
a huge point for the U.S.
Yeah, I was kind of
barely held on, but huge point.
Yeah, I'm still a little disappointed with that. I mean, it's a great point, but I always look at it. I look at what Mexico, how close they kept on going to almost taking the lead versus the limited
amount of time. Dude, I thought we were going to get beat 3-1, 4-1. We never win in Azteca. That place is insane. The U.S. is still gluing it together and figuring it out.
Yeah,
And credit to Bruce Arena for switching the formation, putting 5 in the back. You knew they were going to be coming at them all game, and they figured it out. And Bradley with a huge – that goal sucked the wind right out of the stadium.
Yeah, that was such an awesome goal. It was kind of like, kind of goal.
That place has been ruthless for the U.S., though, I'll take that point.
Yeah, I understand the significance and all that. I look at the big picture where it's still like, all right, we still look like a minor league compared to the big teams. That's what – kind of does, and I still understand we do. In the premature ways, we're still pretty young when it comes to a soccer country, but that's kind of what I was watching ads.
Yeah, the problem is we have so many other options for athletes, and it's not ingrained in the blood of America. It's not Sunday mornings every American's up watching soccer. Every American's doing football or baseball or basketball. Yeah. Some soccer, definitely, big time, but...
What's that kid saying? Plastic?
Christian Pulisic, man.
Pulisic.
Future. The kid is nasty.
It's exciting to hear an American premier soccer player, you know?
And he plays for Dortmund, which is a legit team. Like, that's not like a B-level German team. That's like, it's like Bayern Munich, and then it's like Dortmund's usually right there, and he's getting a lot of playing time with them. So he's 18 and a half years old. Like, he's not even 19 yet. Like, it's exciting. Mm. The problem is they need, like, five of them. Yeah, they need, like, five of him. Like, all these young kids who are,
like,
all
we kept on hearing about Freddie Adu, and it's like, it's happening, and he just fell flat on his face.
We
got
to try to reach out to him.
I'd be down with that.
Oh, absolutely.
But going back to what I was, like... I was watching NASL soccer, like the New York Cosmos playing in Coney Island. Nope. I mean, it wasn't even like it just happened to be on. It was just literally, I'm flipping through the channels, soccer, and I'm watching it.
I like it.
All right. And just the other side, I mean, NASCAR, the guy who took over Trevor Bayne's old 21 car, he just won his first race of his career in Pocono, Ryan Blaney.
So. Oh, Pocono happened?
Yeah.
I would have watched that one. Oh, well. Yeah.
Crazy wreck by Jimmy Johnson. Google that.
I was thinking this the other day. Like, you know, like, I just finished my 10th year at my job. I'm, you know, many times I'm thinking about doing, I want to do something else. And, you know, God willing, be something like this or something.
Yeah.
But I want to be a park ranger.
Yeah.
I think if I could do, like, get rid of the podcast, the editing, the video, the comedy, all that stuff. As, like, an everyday job, I don't think I'd mind being a park ranger.
I could see you doing it. Now, can you see yourself, like, okay, somebody's getting attacked to run out there and do something about it?
I don't even know if that's what they do. I'm picturing just, like, nice big hat, short shorts, like, aggressively short shorts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
hey, pick up that litter.
Yeah, that's all I want to do. I want to just be very, like, no beer in the park, boys. You know, I got to throw it out. I got to take it from you. Have a good day, you know. You know, it's fire season. Be careful out there. No fires. It's dry. Like, I want... Watch out for them copperheads. Watch them out. They'll get you.
They'll get you.
Like, I want that. I want to be outside. I want to, like, wear a weird uniform. Sit in my car and just kind of, like, protect the park. Keep the park clean. I think that's a nice, rewarding job.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not making millions at it, but I feel like that'd be a nice, secure, good job.
It'd be a comfortable job,
Yeah. Okay. Let's get out of here, brother. Anything to promote? Let's get the hell out of here.
Since it's Kevin Garifo's birthday, I will do the Shining Wizards podcast, shiningwizards.com. They're four buddies. They do wrestling podcasts. They talk about the big guys.
I think they
do independence.
What's his name? Big wrestler, long blonde hair, blanking.
Viking.
He was in Fozzie.
Oh, Chris Jericho.
They had him on, I think, recently.
Oh, wow.
It was just pretty awesome.
Yeah, he's kind of off the tour. Well, off of the wrestling and on the tour with Fozzie. But yeah, they're great guys. Check out their podcast. Again, their website is www.shiningwizards.com.
Yeah, I just worked with Kevin last night. He probably had like 10 beers before he went on. It was great. I will just promote... all right, we're back at Tap Pound 15 on June 29th. And this is a cool one because Maine Brewing is sponsoring it. Now, Maine gets like 18 kegs or something like that in New Jersey per month, and we have six of them that night at Tap House. And it's a killer lineup. Mike Morris is headlining.
Great guy.
Joe Conti is featuring, and then Latisse Klappa and Alex Zedrick are also going to be on that show. It's free. Make your reservations at the old Tap House. I think it's already close to sold out. So
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's the room that keeps on giving, that room. So the best thing you guys can do for us, we have had so many good guests. Last week was really cool. The week before that, we had two guys from Coheed and Cambria on. Steven Seagal's the week before, and the Biggest Man in the United States the couple weeks before that, and
Underwater Criminal Investigator Mike Barry.
It's such a good episode. Chef Eric Levine a couple before that. President of the United States. So there's all these episodes, and I'm working on getting a website together where there is like a database of our guests, or where you could see past episodes. I'm trying to get that together in all of my free time. But I would like to get that done. But the best thing you can do is, if you like what you heard today, share it with someone. Comment on something. Send us a message. Hey, I actually listened. Because we're not sure anybody actually listens.
We get numbers.
We're not sure if they're robots. Yeah. They're just people... You know,
we get numbers. Mostly they're zero, but still.
Yeah, well, zero is still a number. That's what Mom always told me.
When they call you a zero, calling you a number, little man.
Yep. Mom, they call me a zero. Zero is a number, little guy.
What does that mean? Shut up.
Podcasts, as great, as amazing and big as they are, I think they're going to be bigger in the future, because who wants to listen to 92.3 K-Rock when you can listen to an hour-long interview for free and get something new every week? So please go to iTunes or any podcast app, Laughable, all those different things, and just type in Verbal Shenanigans. You're not dumb. Subscribe to it. Share it. Let's get the hell out of here, Berlo. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
I see you see me, but you're blowing the line.
I'm looking at you, you're looking at me. We're looking at each other.
Eyes are watching you.
They are
every move.
My eyes.
Wait, not me.
You.
Not mine.